Hello and welcome to Climate Talk Uganda. I'm Josephine Karunji. So in the past few weeks, we've been talking about food prices and how to make sense of them in the context of global trading and local markets. Interesting conversations, with our entire episode last week featuring market traders that William Sechiranda spoke with. And the previous episode, you remember, with Gail and Robert on coffee. Today, we're hoping to tease out the connections between food prices, productivity, and climate change a bit more. And we've got the perfect person to help us do this. Bernard Bashasha is Professor of Agriculture, Economics, and Policy at Makerere University, College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. And we're just going to jump straight in because it's a wide-ranging and very deep conversation. I asked Professor Bashasha first about whether he was in Kampala last week as the flooding happened.
Yes, I watched that. Fortunately, that day I didn't go to town, but I mean, we lost lives, I think. I don't know how many people passed on because of that. So again, that's a sign that the rains are heavier and more intense. Of course, part of that, people are focusing on the construction in waterways and what, and you can't dispute that. That's part of the problem. But again, when you look at the intensity, and I'm sure the climatologists could have traced the intensity of the rainfall, you find that the rains were intense, short and intense, and that means that a lot of water is being poured on the ground at the same time, and it can't just be. The rate of outflow and the rate of inflow are not matching, so that's why I think you have flooding, and that's still also, I think, to be a sign of a changing climate. Also, world over, when you look at other countries, because I have friends who live abroad, they'll be telling you, like in South Korea now, those forest fires, they had never had those fires. And largely they are saying it has been very dry and drier than normal. And so it's a small spark just starts those fires. I think also with snowing and the amounts of snow and the timing of the snow, sometimes more heavier than normal, sometimes less than expected. So all of those, I think, are signs. So there are signs which are here with us, but there are also signs outside of where we are in the globe.
But then you still have some people saying, climate change is something we are making up.
Yes, they are there. And I do know, and some of them actually are very big people. But I think it's a matter of time. It's like we have a diffusion theory in what we teach. There are those people who believe and pick up quickly when something happens. There are those we call laggards, those who will wait, and they're a little bit careful and cautious, over-cautious. But eventually they also adopt. So I think the signs are not going away, and climate change is not going away soon. So I think it's a matter of time that that group will join the believers as well. Even with religion, I mean, it has been over 2,000 years since Jesus Christ lived on the earth, but there are still people who are saying, no. We don't believe in that. So I think some things need time to change, and I think that will happen.
You are largely in the area of agriculture.
Correct.
So give me the relationship between climate change and agriculture.
The connections, Josephine, are quite... There are those which are clear and there are those which are subtle. But from the agriculture point of view, the issues I touched on, apparently our agriculture is rain-fed, as much of it is rain-fed, as you know. So most of the shocks I mentioned, if I can use that word, have direct and indirect impacts on agriculture. So I talked about droughts. When droughts are long and we don't have irrigation, we depend on the rain, then crops are affected. They dry and die. Even the resistant ones like bananas, which keep a lot of water, they also are affected. So productivity is affected. The same happens when you have floods, because floods also can be destructive. If you have a garden of rice or cassava and it is flooded for long, then you have the plants dying.
Are we seeing any new trends in the production, in our agriculture production, as a result of climate change?
Basically, Josephine, I think our agriculture productivity levels have been low. And there are very many factors for that. So I think climate change is just adding to the problems that already exist. And I mean, in the absence of climate change, our productivities would probably be more stable, with less noise. That's what we call variance or variability in the science language. But productivity is generally low in this country for various reasons. We use less fertilizers, the soils are depleted, they are mined, because each time we are harvesting and bringing things in town and we don't get the minerals back to the farm and we don't replenish them with enough inorganic or organic fertilizers. So there are so many other factors responsible for productivity being low, but climate change, I think, contributes to that. But most importantly, I think climate change contributes to the variability, and that's an important element of productivity.
When you say productivity is low in this country, it goes against everything my brain tells me when I'm driving along a highway or anywhere in this country and there's a food market, there's all these markets, there's all this fresh produce. What do you mean our productivity is low?
From our standpoint, Josephine, productivity being low is we have what we measure as yield gaps. By the way, the productivity I'm talking about, larger I'm talking about, because productivity can be in many dimensions. It can be output per person. It can be output per unit land of area. It can be output per unit of capital. So I'm talking about productivity largely with regard to land. So we have what we call yield gaps. That is, we look at what we are potentially able to produce, and that is basically the production at research stations, and then we compare with what farmers get in their fields. Mm-hmm. And that difference is what we use as the yield gap. And the larger it is or the wider it is, the more intense the problem is. So when you look at most of our crops or enterprises or value chains, generally all yield gaps are huge. I have some numbers. I didn't carry them with me, but you would have a disparity of about 70% or 80%. So if cassava at the research station is 7 metric tons per hectare, then at the farm level, it would be just 20% of that. That's what it would mean. So yes, what you see on the street,
along the road,
and we buy and eat, the food is always there just because we have 70% of our population in agriculture. So they are giving us that food, yes, and that's why it is plentiful. But if we are transform and create jobs outside agriculture, such that we have more people in service and manufacturing sectors and fewer people in agriculture, then probably you wouldn't be seeing all that food. So I think what we are seeing now is being pumped up by the numbers, the number of people we have there. So that's everybody produces little, but because there are very many producers, the summation is a big volume that we see in our markets and on the roads.
They say almost every Ugandan is a farmer. Are you a farmer?
Yes, I am. I am, yeah. Josephine.
What are you seeing in your farm? Is climate change affecting it in any way?
I don't do many things. I grow mangoes. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm seeing a lot of insect pest attack that never used to be there before. And I can trace that back to the climate. Also, I think the droughts are longer than they used to be. So I have to try to do a few things, mulching and whatever, to try to conserve the moisture. So there are a few things I'm seeing, but I'm sure those who are growing many more other enterprises are probably seeing much more than I'm seeing, because I'm not a pure 100% farmer.
Do you think that where Uganda stands, we have the ability to affect prices in the commodity markets?
When I look, okay, when you say commodity markets, maybe we look at the three levels. There are those which are purely domestically traded, like the matoke. I don't know that we export a lot of matoke even to the region. Then there are those regional markets. And then there are those international markets. So for international markets, in international trade, Uganda would be considered a small country case. So we are too small to influence even the price of coffee or cotton or cocoa, the products that we trade internationally. So there the answer is no. Even at regional level, I'm not sure there is a commodity we produce so much so that we are a big price influencer. So I think generally the answer is no, just because of our nature. There is no commodity that I can say, Josephine, that we produce in such a large quantities that if we hold or even put more on the market, then we would be able to get to influence the price, the pertaining prices. I can't think of any. At least at the moment, none.
That's a little sad to hear. What are the ways that we could make ourselves more resilient to the changes in global prices in the future?
That's another interesting one, Josephine. I think we need to make ourselves climate proof ourselves. And what do I mean there? We need to go into those enterprises that are resilient to climate change. And I think we've already identified some of them, like coffee, cocoa. Apparently, some value chains of livestock, especially actually our local breeds of livestock. The way we produce coffee and cocoa in this, it's not a pure stand like they do in Brazil and maybe Vietnam and other Arabica coffee producers. Much of ours here tends to be intercropped with trees and bananas, as you know, the system. Mm. And that kind of system tends to be climate-proof, climate-resistant, because there are some, I think, ways and means of how that kind of system resists the intense either flooding or heat. Mm. So those are the enterprises we need to focus on and identify, focus on and support. And as I said, coffee is one of them, cocoa is one of them, and I think some livestock value chains. I can't pin down exact ones beyond the local breeds of livestock. So that's one way. I think the second way would be for us to undertake some investments that tend to minimize the impact of those shocks. Like drought, I think irrigation would be a good approach. Dams and increasing the access to water. Getting involved in pasture production. You know, most of the time in Uganda, we take pasture for granted. It's like the grass has to grow and we feed the cows. But that's no longer the case. The time is coming when pasture is going to be like your maize garden. You look after it, you grow it, you fertilize it, you look for good seeds of pasture. Not that you expect any grass to grow and then the cows will go and eat. So we need improved pasture management systems, we need irrigation, we need water for livestock, and also we need to work on our soils, soil improvement. I think we can't continue running away from fertilizer use forever. It's just not going to happen.
Soil testing.
When we have a population growth rate of about 3%, and the growth in the agriculture is about 1.3%, you can see that you can't go far with those numbers. So we have to look for ways of, actually, as you said, testing, knowing our soils very well, and then putting the right nutrients, so that we. Then nutrient recycling, and when we say replace nutrients, we have to think about both inorganic and organic ways of doing that. But there's also an area that I think has not been very well recognized. The agronomy at the farm is very important. You see, I told you of those yield gaps. If it is soybean and you are told this is the number of plants you need to have per acre, farmers should be taught on exactly having those number of plants. Because if you have more than those, then they are going to outcompete each other. If they say you weed after 1 month, farmers need to know that you weed after 1 month. If we say you weed 2 times, you must weed 2 times. Because if you get a very, very good seed, the genes are very important in all this, what we are talking about. Mm. But then the genes have to be managed the way they are supposed to be managed for us to realize the levels of output that we anticipate. But if you take good genes and mismanage them, you'll not be able to get what is expected of those good genes.
And you might get manage them well, get what's expected, but what happens after harvest?
Usually, if the output is good, even if the price is low, you will at least get something.
Post-harvest handling.
Post-harvest handling is a big issue because for some commodities, especially the perishables like tomatoes and whatever, I understand we lose about 40%. So that's an area, Josephine, thank you for raising that. It's another area where we need to intervene such that what we produce, at least we don't lose half of it. We get as much as we can to the table and to the market. So that's another area, and there are very many strategies I know from the Ministry of Agriculture, Animal Industry and Fisheries, good strategies on paper, but they are not implemented. So on post-harvest management, we know what to do. But also, I can't say we know what to do. Yeah, we know what to do, but we are not doing everything that we need to do. Because some of the enterprises would need cold rooms to be able to preserve them for some time. We need to improve farm storage. If you go on the farm now, the old granaries that some of us grew up using are no longer used because of different reasons, thieves, and they are also not very good in terms of resisting the weathers and other hazards. So, yes, that's another area we need to intervene. So we need to enhance water management, increase pasture production systems,
soil.
Improve our agronomy, work on the soil, work on reducing post-harvest losses, and then I think we would be halfway the journey, not full.
What can we do ourselves?
A lot.
Looking at what's happening with the international community right now.
Yes, the international community, of course, has been shocked by some of the recent changes. But there is a lot we can do on our own, I think. I hate to say this, but it's the truth. The budget for agriculture, I think, from the Treasury has been a bit low. So I think that can be increased a little bit. And some of the increase could be targeting extension and advisory services to get the technology to the farmers. We can also improve our work ethics and love this country a little bit more. And at the local government, also the priorities. I'm looking at, there used to be a model of conditional grants rather than non-conditional from the Treasury. So I think some resources could be conditionally released from the Treasury and directed at the local government, purposely targeting extension delivery and advisory services, such that even if the cow doesn't have fuel, that budget can't be touched because it's conditional on that kind of thing. And so there are a number of things we can do, improving infrastructure on the ground, expanding soil testing services, and maybe having the National Agriculture Research Organization also move a little bit away from the office and the laboratories to the field a little bit more. I know they are doing some bit of on-farm research, but probably that's an area where the National Agriculture Research Organization could also take an extra step. And because there is a failure there, and once there is a failure, some type of intervention might make sense than no intervention at all.
If you had all the power, if you had a magic wand, what would you do different to support our agriculture sector thinking about climate change 10 years from now, 20 years from now?
Again, my answer is going to be a little bit unpalatable to some of your listeners, but I have been places, as I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, maybe before we were on air, I was in South Korea for 3 years as a young man, and I happened to work on their cooperative system, agriculture cooperative system, which is very huge. I spent 5 years in the U.S. while I was doing my PhD studies, Ohio, which is agricultural. And I've been all over places. Agriculture needs support.
Mm.
I know we are in a free... we liberalized. But very few countries liberalize, including their agriculture. So... in most of the countries I know of that have succeeded in agriculture, there is a lot of public support for agriculture. And I don't think we have enough public support in this country. I have said this and it has put me in trouble in some places, but we need cooperatives back. I told you about the situation in Korea. They have what they call Nonghyop. Nonghyop is the Korean cooperative organization. They are in everything. They are massive. They are in petrol stations, they are in banking, they are in what? These are farmers. Getting money from farmers, they support their farmers and they invest the money in all these areas and the proceeds go back to farmers, they give loans to farmers. So if we strengthen the cooperatives, I think the government wouldn't need even to look for these other interventions like the SCF, the Agriculture Credit Facility. I hope you know about that, Josephine, the central bank that is trying to give subsidized loans to farmers. Farmers would do it themselves through a cooperative arrangement. So I think we need institutional reforms in the agriculture sector and more public funding. That's what I would do if I was, if I had the authority.
And just very briefly, because cooperatives, there are a lot of people who have never seen what a cooperative can do.
Mm-hmm.
What would a cooperative help?
Cooperatives would help... First of all, increase the overriding purpose of cooperatives is to empower the farmers. So they would empower them both in backward and forward linkages. And when I say backward linkages, cooperatives will work together to acquire inputs at a cheaper price. Cooperatives will work together to hire extension staff, hire and fire them if they don't deliver. And they would help deal with some of these problems we are talking about. And then also when I say now forward, I'm talking about marketing. Aggregate, commodities, quality, help with managing the post-harvest losses we are talking about, help with identifying markets, help with storage. Because some of where we are let down is storage.
Yeah.
We don't hoard. Not hoarding. Hoarding is the wrong word. We used to have silos, and cooperatives can have silos, such that if there is too much maize production rather than dumping it on the market, demand and supply dictates that if supply increases, I am going to say this, ceteris paribus, other things remaining constant, then the prices would fall. So cooperatives would have that means of storing a buffer stock. You know these things, Josephine. Buffer stock, yes. So cooperatives would empower farmers and empower them for what? To improve their lives, manage their agriculture on their own, take matters in their hands.
So we're basically saying empower the smallholder farmer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Cooperatives would. And you know they cascade from primary, secondary, tertiary, and all the way. Yeah, the models are known. When I was growing up, they were there. Maybe when you were growing up, they were already suffering, but
they were suffering. Yes.
But
they were closing.
Yes. But I also spent some time in the Netherlands. I spent 6 months there. And the program I was doing, they attached me to the dairy subsector. And I saw how their dairy worked because I was actually traveling with a driver in a truck collecting milk. That was a cooperative. The cooperative collects milk from their farmers. We never met even one single farmer. We would just go to the farm and we have the codes. We punch them in. We collect the milk. We record. the quality and everything. We leave everything there. We take the milk to the factory and the farmer gets a check. That's the cooperative. The government is not involved. It's a cooperative that is doing all of that. And then they have their outlets, supermarkets where they are selling their dairy products and everything. Cooperatives work, Josephine. And we know it. And even the big people know it.
Thank you very much, Professor.
You are welcome.
I don't want to make the comment that I was going to make. Bernard Beshasha, Professor of Agriculture Economics and Policy at Makerere University's College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. That was pretty interesting. There's so much to unpack there, so many nuggets to chew on and ideas that we'll definitely dive into in our future episodes. I don't know about you, but I noticed lately that when I hit the market, my mind is all over the place. I'm wondering, have the prices of my usual buys shot up? What's driving that? Where is this trader sourcing their stuff from? And most importantly, is the smallholder farmer at the beginning of this chain actually getting a fair deal? Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love your support to keep the conversation going. It's very easy. Take 2 minutes to share a review and share the podcast with your networks. And we'll see you next time. For Climate Talk Uganda, I am Josephine Karunji.